Dr. Patrick Ball founded the Human Rights Data Analysis Group in 1991 after working in El Salvador to document human rights violations. He developed a database system to analyze and document patterns of abuse during the Salvadorian Civil War. The database played a crucial role in the transition to democracy in El Salvador. Dr. Ball joins the Plutopia podcast this time as we explore the importance of data analysis in combating human rights abuses.
Governments that commit human rights violations do not generally provide us with the data about it. So our methods have been developed over decades specifically to respond to government obfuscation. People who commit violence, and even more so those who apologize for people who commit violence, always lie about it. Always. My experience is not mostly in the United States, mostly what I do. I mean, my colleagues, to kind of close our earlier loop, my colleagues at the Human Rights Data Analysis Group mostly work on U.S. issues now. I do not. I wrote that one paper, and I don't really work much on the U.S. I work in a variety of other countries. But our methods, the methods that we use to figure out what's going on, even when there is no official data, and in the face of official lies, those methods are useful in all these contexts. And so if under your hypothesis that the Trump administration is going to hide data, misrepresent arguments, lie about it, well, our methods will be very useful.
Hey, everybody. Welcome to a new episode of the Plutopia News Network podcast. I'm John Lubkowski. I may not sound like it, but I have a cold, so I may be coughing today. I'm joined by my partner in crime, Scoop Sweeney, and our wonderful co-host, Wendy Grossman. And our guest today is Patrick Ball, who is a statistician, and he's known for his quantitative analyses of human rights violations and providing those kinds of statistical analyses to truth commissions, non-governmental organizations, NGOs, international criminal tribunals, and United Nations missions. He is the director of research at Human Rights Data Analysis Group, HRDAG. Do you say that, HRDAG?
HRDAG.
And HRDAG conducts statistical analyses to document patterns of human rights abuses. So welcome, Patrick. We're so happy to have you with us. It's been years.
Glad to be here. Yes, a long time.
Probably a decade or more.
I think we first met 25 years ago, John.
Yep, I think you're probably right.
Maybe 27 years ago, now that I do a little algebra. Yeah.
Oh, my gosh. Well, we're happy to have you here, and I guess I'll toss out the first question here. I'm wondering what inspired you or you and others to establish HRDAG and how it's evolved since you started it. I guess 1991, is that when you started it?
Yes. Yes. In 1991, I had sort of gotten a little frustrated and wasn't really sure what I was doing in graduate school. So I wandered off to El Salvador because I wanted to see what was going to happen as the war wound down. There'd been a big offensive by the insurgents in 1989 that had failed. And in 1991, it was clear there was a peace deal in the cards. It was about to happen. And so I thought, well, I'd like to see it. And so I wanted to do that as part of the human rights movement. So I joined a group called Peace Brigades International, which did and continues to do this day, a nonviolent accompaniment where you hang around with people who are the likely targets of political violence. And the theory is that by hanging around, you provide witness so that the people who want to commit that violence don't do it because you're there watching. And it worked. At least it worked while I was there. But the reason I went, right, was because the war was ending. So as the war ended, our job became less useful. I did it for, I guess, about 6 months, and then the war ended. And I got a job offer. And the job offer was from a human rights group, the Non-Government Human Rights Commission of El Salvador. And they had found out that I'd been a database programmer in the 1980s. And they asked me to write a database for them. So I was pretty excited by that idea. I mean, this was 1991. Microcomputers were terrible. Database software was appallingly bad. You couldn't write a file without file corruption. You couldn't create an index without it being wrong. So it was a fun problem. It was a frustrating problem, but it was fun. So I started working with them. And at the end of about a year, we had a pretty cool analysis that enabled us to do something that people would have never been able to do before computing, which was this. We have 10,000 stories. 10,000 people have told us their stories over the last about 15 years. And those stories have been typed up on paper because it's the 1980s. And they have literally been typed on carbon copies. So what we have now are the carbon copies of the originally typed stories, because the originals had been destroyed in a series of attacks on the office. But the people who'd done all this were really smart. So they had taken copies and hidden them outside of the office in various places, including in Mexico, and then brought them back at the end of the war. So we're going through these carbon copies and we're learning the stories that people have told in a very formal legal deposition style. Okay, that will give us a list of horrible events, which we can render as database records. It's not a simple process, but I'll ignore that for now. So we can create database records of that. And we created about 40,000 plus minus database records of the worst things that can possibly happen to people. Murders, sexual assault, disappearance, illegal detention, the destruction of people's property, torture, all this terrible stuff that had happened. Great. That's what human rights movement had been doing for decades. Telling the story from the victim's point of view. What we added and what was really cool is that we said, okay, who did it? Now, we don't know necessarily the individuals who committed each crime, but we do know for almost every one of those violent events, the institution that did it. So if you know that it was, let's say, the 1st Brigade, and it happened in 1986, you can figure out who the commander of the 1st Brigade was in 1986 and then assign this violation to him. You can create a dossier on every commander in the, you know, about 100 different units across the Salvadoran military. You create a dossier of all of the violent events that people have reported against that by doing essentially a bunch of database joins. And it was a crazy hack. And as I said, the database software is terrible. And you know, we had 640 kilobytes of RAM. Here I am, Grandpa Patrick, telling stories about ancient microcomputing. But it worked. And we were able to publish these dossiers. And they played a really key role in the transition between the war and the period of relative democracy, which El Salvador had until about 5 years ago. So, which is the longest period of democracy in El Salvador's history, by the way.
How long did it take you to work out the data structures for that thing? Initially,
well, it months. But the thing is that I spent months doing it, and every one of them was wrong. Once I realized what the right structure was, it took about 4 days. I mean, that's the story of every project I've ever worked on: is you spend months doing it wrong, and then when you get it right, it just falls into place.
One of the things that when we first started talking about your work that you told me about was taking multiple streams of evidence. Mm-hmm. Of different kinds of data and learning how to put them together so you could see where the gaps were and where the known knowns, how they matched up and right. Where the unknown unknowns were. You, as I recall, you call it multiple streams estimation.
Systems estimation.
Yes.
So that's a formal statistical technique that I consider part of a class of methods whereby we use lots of different kinds of data to tell a story. So the first story that I just gave you from El Salvador is one such example. So we have victim testimony, and we have all sorts of information about military hierarchy and the military structure. The order of battle is what military people call it. And the order of battle evolving over the period from 1977 to 1981. And so you have to do is put together these two different streams to tell the story of individual military accountability. The formal method you've just asked about, multiple systems estimation, uses multiple independent enumerations or lists of a particular thing. And in my career, that's almost always been fatal violations, which includes deaths and disappearances, things where people have died. And so we have lists of people's deaths And our job is to figure out how many deaths we don't have, how many are not on any of those lists. The story of missing data is kind of the thing that I've spent my whole career thinking about is we get all this weird data, what's not there? And how can we tell a rigorous statistical story even when we don't have all the data? The joke in our team is, if the data were perfect, lawyers would do this with Excel. And lawyers don't do it with Excel because, and they hire statisticians and programmers because the data is broken. So you put all these data, you get, let's say, three data sets and you link them. That's called a record linkage or matching, where you determine if a record in A is also in B. Is that the same guy in these two different data sets, or are they different? And you do that tens or hundreds of thousands of times to figure out which records are intersecting across a set of data. Now, if you have two systems, you can do a little clever trick, which is to say, okay, I have two data sets. One's called A, one's called B. I've matched them. And I know that the set of intersection between the two is M, the match set, which is a subset of A and a subset of B. We know how big A, B, and M are. And so if we make some probability assumptions, we can say that there's some population N, which is what statisticians would call it, from which A and B have been drawn, okay? And we can ask the probability that A, in my case, a death, in this population N has been sampled by Project A. Well, it's the number of records in A divided by N. We don't know N yet, but we know that relationship. And we can say the same thing about B. We can say that the probability that a death in population N has been sampled by B is B over N. Well, we know M, right? We put the two data sets together. We have the set M. So we can say the probability that a death is in A and B is M over N. Okay, here's the cool thing. If we have two independent events and we ask the probability of the two events occurring together, that is equal to the product of the two probabilities. So it's just like if I throw two coins and I say, what's the probability I have two heads? Well, the probability of first head is 0.5. The probability of the second head is also 0.5. The probability that I've thrown two heads is 0.5 times 0.5. It's 0.25. Right? It's 1/4. And you know that you can say, well, it could have been head-head. It could have been tail-head. It could have been head-tail. It could have been tail-tail. I asked about head-head. It's 1/4. So that's how you get to this notion of independent probabilities. You multiply them together and you get the probability of the compound event. Okay, cool. Well, if M over N, which is being in both, is equal to A over N times B over N, seventh grade algebra, right? We multiply both sides by N squared. You get M N equals AB, you divide by M, now you have N, which is what we're looking for, is equal to AB over M. I love that. That is so exciting to me. That is amazing because we just learned something we didn't know before with algebra. Like, we didn't know how many there were in N, and now we don't exactly know, but we have a way of estimating it with known probability assumptions. And you know, the reason that academic statisticians spend their entire careers working on this problem is because those probability assumptions are complex and really interesting. And we've refined this method over about the last 100 years. This method was first invented by Laplace, the French mathematician Laplace, in 1783, as he was correcting the French census, on the eve of the French Revolution. And so it's been around forever. But in the last 100 years, and particularly in the last 40 years, there's been enormous advance on this method. And we really enjoy meeting with academic statisticians and learning their ideas and either adopting their software or sometimes writing our own software to do these calculations to adjust for all those probability assumptions. It gets much more interesting if instead of two lists, you have three, four, five. In Colombia, we had 35 different lists of homicides and disappearances that we were matching across and that we were then using to do all the control for what's not in any of them. And it's a really, it's just a fun problem. You get lucky sometimes in your career and choose the right problem to work on for a while and you get cool results.
Yeah, once you get the results, what do you do with them?
Every project's different. It depends on the political context that we're working in. So sometimes all that matters is to tell a public story. You're just doing advocacy. And you're hoping that that means that you will persuade someone that this is important and that you can do something useful with their help. I do that sometimes, but most of my work is in a more applied context. So in the context of what are called truth commissions, where at the end of a dictatorship or a civil war, a country will set up a group that's made up of commissioners who are made up of parties, people from all the different parties to the conflict, and they will write a consensus history about what happened. One of the most important things for a population that has suffered terribly is to have that suffering acknowledged in an official way, written down and said, this is what happened. That says in a way that this is what happened in this terrible thing we've all just survived. So truth commissions are a mechanism for doing exactly that.
Well, the your group has quite a history in other countries, you know, compiling all this data. What about the United States? There are many disappearances, illegal, you know, murders and kidnappings, that kind of thing. Do you qualify those events in the United States?
So in fact, my single most cited paper by like a factor of five is on homicides by police in the United States. This is back in, I think I wrote that in 2015, something like that. And the question is, in the United States, because we have a federal system, there is no obligation for many of the country's police forces to report to anyone when they kill someone. There are 18,000 plus minus police jurisdictions in the United States who are authorized to carry a badge and a gun and arrest people. They exist at every level, right? They exist municipal levels, county levels, state levels, federal levels, as well as all sorts of mishmashes of those forms, and as well as parks and schools and a variety of other things. Federal officials, federal police report killings to the FBI. Some states have an obligation to report to their state officials, including California, Texas, and Connecticut, and a few more. And some of those states have, as a matter of policy, reporting to the federal government, but relatively few. So back 25 years ago, when Congress wanted to know how many homicides by police there were, they asked the Bureau of Justice Statistics, which is part of the Department of Justice. They're really good statisticians. They're, you know, amazingly good at their jobs. And the BJS said, well, we don't know. And Congress said, what do you mean you don't know? How can you not know? And BJS explained the same thing I just explained to you. And Congress says, well, what can you do? And they said, well, I guess we could read the newspaper. And so in all seriousness, in order to know the number of police homicides in the United States, the Department of Justice monitors the media. I am not kidding. This is so insane to me.
And The Guardian was tracking police killings in the United States.
Yeah, there's a bunch of media sources, and they're all terrible, honestly. I shouldn't say that super out loud, but the Washington Post has one too. And the reason that they're terrible is that they all take some sort of specific spin on it, and they just exclude a bunch. So the Washington Post spin on it is shootings by police, as though the police don't kill people in other ways. And the Guardian's project was just, I have to say, somewhat haphazardly done. There are non-governmental efforts, particularly by a former journalist in Nevada, that have been astonishingly good. So there are new projects, but these are all much newer. These have all come long after this project I'm describing. These are all basically 2017, 2018, 2019 is when they got started. And the media, I mean, honestly, the big media organizations, they get interested and then they lose interest and the projects just are haphazard. The nonprofits do a much better job. So, go ahead.
Well, I was just going to say, I was in a debate the other day with some people, actually this was on the Well, about the number of police homicides, not just police homicides, but killings where they killed someone who was unarmed. Mm-hmm. So I guess that's what qualifies as a police homicide. You kill somebody who's not armed. I mean, I guess that raises the question, how do you define whether it's a homicide?
It's a homicide if someone kills someone else. Whether it's a justifiable or legal homicide, completely outside my scope. Completely outside my scope.
So we were debating about this, and people were throwing numbers around and pointing to studies. And the argument was that there's far fewer of those than people think there are. You know, there was some study that said that a number of people thought that 1,000 people a year, unarmed, like people, were being killed by police, and that actually was far fewer than that, 30 or something. And one of the things that
Either
I was
of those
wondering
numbers is right.
Well, I believe that, and that's kind of an issue. It's kind of like the issue I have with polls. People put a lot of faith in poll data as being representative of what people are thinking. But the only people it's representative of is the people who were polled, right? So
no.
I guess my question is about, do you read too much into statistics? No, you don't think so?
No. I mean, look, there's always a question about whether a study's been done well. And we can have, a useful and I think intellectually rich debate about whether or not a specific study that's addressing a particular question is done well or done poorly. Yes. And I would say that one of the first things we can say when we're assessing magnitude, I'm not going to address polling, but when we're addressing the magnitude of a particular event like police killings, the first thing we can ask is, well, what's not in the study? What's missing? And in the context of police homicides, we know there's three categories of homicides that are consistently and systematically missing from official reporting. And from, for the most part, media reporting. One is homicides on Indian reservations, which tend to be tremendously, tremendously underreported. Those are homicides by reservation police as well as by federal officials. The second is the homicide against undocumented people. People who are in the United States without official immigration status. They tend to be barely reported because all the people who know about it have a lot to lose if they open their mouths. And so they're much more vulnerable than a citizen. So they, I think, you know, make the reasonable decision to not talk about things in public. So unless the homicide's been, you know, is on video or something, which relatively few are, then people don't report it. And the third category of homicides that tend to be underreported are the homicides of unhoused people. So when people, you know, homeless people, they don't, you know, nobody talks about it for the same reason that undocumented people don't. Now, these are also three categories of people who get killed much more often than other people. So if you put together those two observations, that these are systematically underobserved categories of homicide and categories of people more likely to be killed, then you realize, wow, there's going to be a lot of homicides that are not in anybody's reporting, whether they're media accounts or official accounts. What my study said in 2015 is that there are plus minus about 1,500 police homicides a year. Now, how many of those are against unarmed people? How many are legally justified? Well, we know the legally justified number because all the legally justified, that is those that have had an official finding that it was a legit shooting, those are in something called the FBI Supplemental Homicide Report. Now, there's only about 500 of those a year. So about a third of total homicides are ruled as completely legit. Now, that doesn't mean the other 1,000 are not legit. It just means nobody ruled on it. And what happens is when a ruling is going to be in the direction of that it was an illegal killing, usually the proceeding gets stopped in one way or another. So we don't end up with a ruling. We don't know either way. So how many are unarmed? I would say the number's probably closer to 500 than it is to 30, but it's not 1,000 either. And that's unarmed with anything. I don't mean they're armed without a knife, without a spoon, without a stick, not just a firearm.
Yeah, I've been reading a lot about the indigenous communities in the United States. The disappearance of indigenous women is a big issue that doesn't seem to be getting a lot of attention or at all by the Trump administration or the law enforcement under his administration. Have you tracked much in the indigenous tribes of their the crimes against them, against the women, and a lot of murders that go apparently unnoticed?
Mm-hmm. Well, let me clarify what it is that we do. We don't track deaths. That is not our job. Let me be super clear. Okay. That is not what our organization does. We are four full-time professionals and a couple of support staff. What we do is the data analysis for groups who do track. Okay. So we're the back-end nerds. We are not the people out there documenting individual deaths. That kind of work of journalism or of human rights advocacy or human rights assistance, direct assistance, lots of other people do that. We help them. Okay. So I'm never tracking somebody else's work. We'll do studies if people ask us. And so one that's related to that is the disappearance of girls and women, particularly Black girls and women in Chicago. So we have been part of a long-term project with a partner called the Invisible Institute in Chicago that tracks the disappearance of girls and women in a project called the Beneath the Surface Project. This project won a Pulitzer last year or the year before, I can't remember, but recently for their work documenting this. And we helped them with the data analysis and the machine learning to analyze those patterns. So we do work on that, but not in a direct way. You've got to be clear what our role is. Our partners are always out front. We're just footnotes for the graphs and tables. That's where we want to be.
Okay, I have a question, and I'm going to share my screen briefly here. Mm-hmm. And you'll notice, so this is the Bureau of Justice Statistics, the BJS. Mm-hmm. When you mentioned them, the first thought that I had was, do they still exist?
Oh, yeah.
And then I checked to see if they still exist. And it says that they're reviewing, it's reviewing its websites and materials in accordance with recent executive orders and related guidance. Oh, and dear. Some pages and publications will be unavailable. Mm-hmm. So I'm just wondering about, I mean, kind of overall, I think we all have the understanding that government is now starting to do more things in secret and also is starting to manage information in ways that may be orthogonal to the truth. And I suppose I'm wondering whether you are likely to be engaged in more studies that sort of look behind the wall of what's happening with governance in the United States now under a regime that really chooses to hide as much as it can.
Well, I mean, I think that's it's a really useful and on-point remark, because governments that commit human rights violations do not generally provide us with the data about it. So our methods have been developed over decades specifically to respond to government obfuscation. People who commit violence, and even more so those who apologize for people who commit violence, always lie about it. Always. My experience is not mostly in the United States, mostly what I do. I mean, my colleagues, to kind of close our earlier loop, my colleagues at the Human Rights Data Analysis Group mostly work on U.S. issues now. I do not. I wrote that one paper, and I don't really work much on the U.S. I work in a variety of other countries. But our methods, the methods that we use to figure out what's going on, even when there is no official data, and in the face of official lies, those methods are useful in all these contexts. And so if under your hypothesis that the Trump administration is going to hide data, misrepresent arguments, lie about it, well, our methods will be very useful. Whether we do it or we train others to do it, I'm delighted to be helpful to anyone who wants to figure out what's really going on, whatever the context. That's often useful, even if government is trying to be above board and provide official data. It can be a useful check on that. If government is going to be deliberately untruthful, well, even more interesting, even more useful. I think I look to folks like you to figure out if anybody would like to listen to it.
When I went back to your website recently, I was intrigued to see that your latest annual report has a bunch of stuff about how you use AI. Mm-hmm. I was a little surprised just because the last time we spoke, you were pretty scathing about some of the statistical stuff that was going on at the time, where people were sort of throwing out the necessity to show correlation in the interests of, hey, look, there's this pattern in this big pile of data. Isn't that great? We have a pattern. Yep. And so I'd be interested to hear how you've sort of adopted, what parts of AI you've adopted and how you're working with it.
Well, let's walk through. I'd say there's sort of four steps from classical statistics to where we are now. And one of them was, in classical statistics, we had these very carefully curated data sets, and we did very specific kinds of tests on these very carefully curated data sets. And touching a point that John raised earlier, one of the ways we curated those data sets was through very careful sampling. We chose ways to get that data from the world in ways specifically so that the data we chose would represent much more than the data we chose. We chose representative samples, and there was a lot of math. In the 20th century, people spent an enormous effort to figure out how to do the math to get a representative random sample.
Right, and that's how polls were constructed.
Yes, and polls are very different now because you can't sample people anymore. No one answers the phone. So you have to do all sorts of other things. Those are complicated. And we have now, I'd say, rather than polls getting worse, what we have is much rapidly escalating assumptions and expectations about what we think polls do. And so if I can sit down with someone and explain what a poll does, they will let go, if they're willing to be persuaded, they will let go of their, well, polls don't work. Polls work fine. You have to understand what polls do, but that's not my job here. I'm not a polling expert. But moving on, the second stage of that was this, there was a sort of, I thought of the big data bullshit phase. And that's the phase when you and I encountered each other. And what happened is that we developed tools and we got data faster than we could figure out how to use them effectively. And so what people thought is, we have so much data and we have these tools that can process not twice as much data or even 10 times as much data or even 100 times. We have thousands of times more data than we had 5 years ago. What can we do? And what people did is they just threw classical tools at those data sets and they found all sorts of relationships. And they said, aha, we have found the truth. Well, no, what we found is artifacts of random variation in the data. If you have enough data, you'll find correlations. If I generate a perfectly random data set, I'll find correlations if it's big enough, because correlations can be found even in randomness. It's just that those are spurious, meaningless correlations.
Right, right. I misspoke. I said correlation, but I meant causation that people threw out the window.
Well, yeah, I mean, in the era of this big data bullshit, people like said causation doesn't matter. And I mean, exactly. That was the way they kind of escaped it. Now, causation matters less than I think a lot of people think it does, but there's a whole nother branch of statistics, which is rebuilt on a rigorous foundation, what it means to argue causation in statistics. And now there is really good stuff on that. It's not an area that I work on, but I admire their work. There's the sort of third phase, which was the machine learning phase. And in the machine learning phase, there was a lot of bad work in this phase, but there was also some really exciting work. And that was enabled us to tease out really subtle patterns in ways that didn't fall into the, oh, we found a correlation, we found something, but rather we can actually really, really figure out things about missing data. And that was amazing. And I have a really exciting project I've done in Mexico where we predict the locations where we are likely to find hidden graves of disappeared people. And this has been a really successful project. We found tons of graves. It's been running since 2017. And it was a very careful project in the sense that we had to be really thoughtful about what we were predicting. We're not predicting graves in the future. We're predicting graves that are already there. We just have not yet observed. We haven't found them.
Which is a great test of your predictive ability also.
Right. Right. So that project is, you know, the dream of everyone who builds something is that someone else takes it over and makes it better. Yay. And that's just one of my biggest successes, because now it's much better because other people have made it much better. And then the fourth wave is now, when we have generative, or I think of them more as extractive tools. Large language models give us this other set of tools. Now, One of the things that we've had to do forever, and that anyone who uses data from the world has had to do, is how do you convert heterogeneous, mostly qualitative data that could be in text, it could be in audio, it could be in video, it could be in images, it could be in buried in weird file formats. How do you get that out and make it into usable records that you can then do some kind of statistical thing with? And the traditional way people did this in the 20th century was we had human beings read stuff and make records in spreadsheets. And so they coded it out. And this was exhausting. It was really slow. It was error prone. And you had to do it all twice or three times in order to get data that you could trust was reliable. Well, LLMs can do that. And it turns out that LLMs can do it about as well as the best people can. And of course, they do it wildly faster. Now, they don't do it perfectly, but the best people didn't do it perfectly either. But we can do it with really careful supervision. Now, that's a term of art in statistics and in data science, supervision. But with very, very careful supervision, we can use AI to not find the patterns, but to find the structure of the data that we can extract and then do other kinds of statistical work with that will get us to the patterns. And in particular, just imagine that we have those, the work I started my stories with, those 10,000 depositions from El Salvador, you know, something like 250,000 pages. We could have an LLM read that and identify every homicide along with its location and its date and some of the details about how it happened and who, what military unit was accused of having done it. They could do that in an hour, as opposed to over 40 people working for a year. And so that's the kind of power that we get from LLMs. It's not that the LLMs, again, it's not that the LLMs tell us the patterns. It's not at all that linear. It's that the LLMs do the work that people would have done, reading out through all the text and showing us the records. And then with the records, we can take that forward and do the patterns. We use this again in a very supervised context, which means we still have people doing it. People do the same work. They just only have to do a tiny bit. And then we can use their work to check the LLMs and to see if the LLM is doing it right. And that's how we know that an LLM can do the work about as well as the best people can.
Yeah, that was going to be my question. That was one question I had was how much checking you have to do. I mean, obviously, you don't just dump tons of data into an LLM and assume that the output, whatever output you get, however it's organized, is correct or meaningful. Is that kind of what you're saying? You really do have to check it.
Well, let's just be super explicit about what we mean by checking. Okay. I don't sit there looking at it. That's not checking. What checking means is that some person has done some subset. And a lot of the rigor in this process is choosing that subset. You have to choose the subset that a human being looks at in a way that represents the entire corpus. So you've got this mass corpus of, let's say, not at all hypothetically, every civilian complaint against the police in the state of Illinois for 10 years. Not hypothetical. Those are now public records because amazing journalists have forced the state of Illinois to disclose all civilian complaints against the police as a matter of public record. Amazing. All right. Now you have hundreds and hundreds of thousands of PDFs. Now what? All right. You have to convert those PDFs into some sort of usable structure. You have to say, Officer X beat up person Y on such and such a date. And here's the sequence of events that followed that in the process of the local police department's determination about whether that should be sustained or not. Now, even if it's not sustained, it's still interesting information. It may be that it wasn't sustained for reasons that we disagree with. But nonetheless, you have to follow that through. So you want to extract all those pieces. So that's not just reading the PDF, it's reading this PDF and maybe three more PDFs and putting that all together. How do you know that was done correctly? Because you have to have selected a small number of PDFs, and I'm talking high hundreds, not dozens, and have a human being do the same thing. A human being reads through, extracts exactly the same records. And this creates an expectation for what we think the LLM should do. We then look at the LLM's output link it exactly together and say, exactly how close are they? And you have some threshold for how much you'll accept. Now, it may be if they disagree, the person was wrong. It may be that the LLM was wrong. This requires another level of review. When they disagree, you have to go back and figure out what's different, who's right. And then you have to figure out a way to fine tune what you're asking the LLM to do in a subsequent pass. And you iterate in this way, repeating it so that the person and then the LLM come into consistency together. And when they're consistent, you let it rip. But let's go back to what people do. When human beings read a document and they say, oh, well, here's a list of all the homicides in this document, we didn't believe them either. We would have more than one person do that on the same document. And then we would compare their work across all the human beings and say, did the people agree with each other? Sometimes they did, sometimes they didn't. That measure, there's a technical measure of inter-rater reliability. There's actually a number, there's a whole class of measures. But the statisticians have been working on this problem for decades. How do you know when you have converted information across formats in a way that is consistent with what you believe your best practice to be? So now we apply that logic to testing whether an LLM is doing this. And when you get it to a point where you believe that it is, because again, you've sampled a representative set from across your entire corpus and you've had the tests run across all that set, then you say, great, let's do it. And then you believe it. Now, is it meaningful? Yeah, that's again, was the homicide legitimate? We don't know. What we know is what's in the documents and what we can say about them. We are not bringing external validation or judgment to it. That's not our job. That's lawyers' jobs, that's advocates' jobs, that's journalists' jobs, that's other people who bring their disciplinary and sort of political background to it. Our job is to figure out what's there.
Yeah, I think a lot of people would think that you create a data structure and then you put the data into that structure, but really kind of what we're talking about is finding the structure in the data versus imposing a structure on the data, right?
It depends on the project, but I'm usually imposing, to be fair. I'm saying I'm looking for the homicide. A homicide is going to have a victim's first name and last name. The victim's going to have an age, a sex, a date of birth. The event will have occurred at a certain place on a certain location. It will have information about the perpetrator. It will have additional information about the context. Any or all of this information may be missing, but that's what I'm expecting. Please find those pieces. So I'm imposing. And I keep coming back to homicide because it's the most immediately comprehensible way we can talk about violence. It gets wildly more complex when it's other kinds of violence. And it wouldn't fit in a brief conversation that we're having. No.
I'm wondering, what would your evil twin do? And by what I mean by that is, let's assume that there's somebody within, let's argue that the Trump regime may be capable of doing evil. I think that that argument has been made a few times. So if they took a counterpart, somebody like you, what might that person do with data?
Well, we don't have to hypothesize about this.
Okay.
The entire field of the creation of misinformation is the anti-me. So what people do, and this isn't by any means a US-centric example. All around the world, people use LLMs to generate misinformation. And you generate misinformation to create hate and sow divisions between sectors of societies in order to mobilize your side against that side. That's why people do it, to gain power. You create misinformation in order to drown real information. I mean, the phrase in the U.S. in U.S. politics is flood the zone with shit. That's what Steve Bannon says over and over again. And the reason you do that is because it's impossible to criticize people who on your side are seizing power if nobody believes anything. If you can create cynicism and, this sort of do your own research skepticism leads people to believe whatever is convenient to them in the moment rather than having any kind of rigorous mechanism for deciding what is really true. So there is no need to hypothesize about what an evil me would do. There are zillions of them and they are immensely well paid.
And what's the antidote?
I don't know. I just am going to keep doing what I do, which is to create the most rigorous analysis of state violence that we can humanly do. That's what we're going to keep doing.
Who did what to whom, as I recall?
Yes, that is one of our catchphrases. That's also, by the way, John, the data structure I settled on in El Salvador all those years ago. That's a database record. Who did what to whom? Those are the fields.
And you're looking for a revelation of the truth. I mean, really, we're talking about statistical truth here on your end.
Yes, I would
and
qualify
the evil
that
twin
slightly.
Is okay. Yes. Go ahead.
I would qualify that slightly, which is that when there is a statistical truth, it comes with quantified uncertainty. So if I don't have all the data, I don't know the answer to three decimal places or even to an integer. What I know is what the range of answers almost certainly is. And I can explain almost certainly in very formal and rigorous terms. And that range is not, you know, from 100 to 300. It's probably about 220. It might be 210. It might be 230. It probably isn't 150. It almost certainly isn't 275. And you can maybe tell a story where it's 100 and maybe tell a story where it's 300, but you're really out there at that point. So what I'm saying is that the uncertainty has gradations within the range.
I was just going to say, what's unfortunate is that people seem to really like certainty and they really like absurdly specific, you know, 133.2, you know,
right.
Because they think if it has more decimal points, it's somehow more likely to be true because somebody's worked it out in detail.
Yeah, I would actually say that's a combination of naivete and believing people who are flooding the zone with shit.
Yeah.
That part of what flooding the zone with shit's all about is discrediting any kind of rigorous or scientific pushback.
Right.
And the one of the ways you do that is you figure out what scientists do and then convince everybody that that's bad. So, you know, yeah, overly precise argument is probably nonsense.
The confidence interval thing, I so often wish that people would cite confidence intervals when they're putting statistics in a story. And one of the examples of that I think most people would understand is that in tennis tournaments now, they have this automated line calling thing called Hawkeye, and it has, I think it has an error of maybe 3 millimeters either way.
Mm-hmm.
But they never say, you know, within a certain, when they say that the thing has made the call, they never say it's within X amount of certainty. They just say, they treat it as though it's infallible, even though sometimes there have been cases where it was egregiously and obviously wrong. And there was a couple of statisticians who wrote a little book about it and said, you know, that they lost a great opportunity to educate the public because they could have said, you know, within a certain, you know, margin of error of X. And people would have seen that every day when they were watching a sporting event, and they would have gradually learned what that meant. And I agree with them. I think it is unfortunate.
We do it all the time in normal speech, right? You say,
yeah.
You know, how long is it going to take you to get there? Oh, about 20 minutes. Might be 15,
ish.
Might be 25.
People use ish a lot.
You say ish. And you say, well, does that mean you don't know? You're like, I do know. It's not going to take me 10 hours. And it's not going to take me 1 second. It's probably going to take around 15 minutes. It might take 25. It might take 15. It's not going to take 10 hours. So you know what you can rule out. You know what the likely range is. That's what we're talking about here. And so we don't, when people say, oh, it's going to take me 15 minutes and 43 seconds. Yeah, that's ridiculous. You just made that up.
Yeah, because there's always variables that are outside your control.
We call that random variation.
Right.
And that random variation happens randomly all the time. But it doesn't change the story completely. It just makes it a little fuzzy. But you can still make out the outlines.
Yeah, you can always come up with exceptions. Like,
if you repeat something enough times, even wildly improbable events get happen.
Right. The law, one of the skeptics used to call that the law of truly large numbers.
Okay. Yeah. I mean, black swan events are what the finance people are, you know, Nassim Taleb calls them. I mean, there are black swan events. They're just incredibly rare.
Or the two-hour drive that takes you 14 hours because you're actually driving home from seeing a total solar eclipse.
Sure.
And everybody else is on the road at the same time.
Well, that might not be a black swan. That was entirely foreseeable, but yes.
Yes, but it's an amazing number of people failed to foresee it, and that's why it took 14 hours. I mean, I wasn't the person involved. But... John, did you have another question?
Well, it wasn't so much a question. I wanted to acknowledge the existence of this newsletter.
Oh, brand new.
Yeah. So tell
us
about this.
We don't even have one out yet.
Yeah, I see that. What are you going to do with Structural Zero? This is a Substack newsletter, I should add.
This is our brand new newsletter that we're working with. Our whole team is going to be writing them. And we're going to just take on topics that we think are really fun and interesting and try to write a few hundred words or 1,000 words or something about why it's interesting. I mean, obviously, I'm going to be talking about uncertainty. It's kind of my favorite thing to talk about. And I'll be using these different analogies to how long does it take us to get somewhere or, you know, how far away is something when we're guessing or things like that. And my colleagues and I will be writing them up, and we'll also pick up things that we're doing right now, specific things that we're doing recently. One of the things that we're doing some in California, I'm not doing it, my colleagues are, is working on something called the Racial Justice Act. And the Racial Justice Act in California says that if a prosecutor has particularly used enhancements for sentencing that are only ever used or almost exclusively used for one ethnic group in a particular area, then that is subject to judicial review and perhaps reversal. And these particularly around sentencing. This is not specifically around determining whether someone has done it or not, but rather, well, you did this thing, but you're a member of a gang, so you get 10 more years. But who gets labeled as a gang member? Well, that in some jurisdictions is people of only one race or ethnicity. And the California legislature decided that that kind of usage of these enhancements should be subject to additional judicial review. Well, how do you know? If you're a defense lawyer and you're bringing a case on appeal, how do you know if this particular enhancement is only ever used against people of one ethnicity or not? Well, that turns out to be a statistical question, and my colleagues are doing work on it. And so we will probably be writing some about that. We have some stuff on our website about it, and we'll put together slightly deeper dives, but also a little bit more contextually grounded pieces for the newsletter.
How are you funded? And I ask partly because I'm wondering if you're dependent at all on government funds that might be ripped away.
Well, no, we not directly. It's been well over 10, probably more than 15 years since we took any money from the U.S. government, the federal government. Our partners, many of our partners, are funded by various governments. We sometimes get money from European governments. My work in Colombia was funded by the British, German, and Swiss governments. We sometimes get money from the UN, although it's never very much. And most of our money comes from, and we sometimes get money from individual donations. Those are immensely welcome. We are very grateful for those. Most of our funding comes from private foundations who are supporting us as a kind of infrastructure for the projects that they want to see happen. They want to see a project happen to do, for example, to support a truth commission in some country. Well, we're part of the infrastructure for that. If you want that truth commission to be rigorous, you know, we're one of the ways you could get them to have good data practices and good statistics.
You ever find yourself working on a project you'd rather you weren't working on?
No. And that's because we say no all the time. We're really careful about what we choose. We're in the position of being asked to do way more work than we can possibly do. So we get to subject each project that comes in to a 5-point sort of discussion thing. The 5 points are not like you have to satisfy all of them or you vote or anything like that, but they're a way that we shape either the conversation that we have about whether we're going to take on any given project. The points are on our website if people want to dig around in the about page. But we make a really thoughtful determination about whether we're going to take something on before we dive in. And I mean, I can't say I never, ever regret doing anything. But if we regret doing something for reasons that we think, you know, that it's the project's unethical or that the data is bad, we'll just stop doing it. We'll say, no, this isn't working. It's way more important to us to only publish things that we think are entirely defensible top to bottom, that we're going to live with forever, because people still ask me about stuff I did in the 90s. I have to be ready to defend something, you know, as long as I've put my hands on a keyboard. And I tell that to everybody who joins HRDAG, that you have to be, if you're going to take something on and publish on it and support our partners, you have to be ready to support that and defend it forever.
But you do probably, I assume you stumble into the occasional ethical dilemma, no?
Sure. I mean, I won't give details, but there have been any number of projects where the findings that we made were not consistent with what our partner thought reality was. And they got upset about it. They're like, no, it's way more than that. It can't be that number. Or no, it isn't that group, it's this other group. Or we find that violence is equally distributed across, for example, two different ethnicities. And they say, no, it was genocide. And they're like, well, maybe it was, maybe it wasn't, but the statistics are not consistent with that argument. We say that whenever we see it. Now,
oh, that's very interesting.
Those projects are not on our website because those projects just didn't get published. They didn't happen. But it does happen. And the one that we did publish that got us controversy and we still get controversy about was from Timor-Leste, you know, which is a tiny little half island sort of in between Indonesia and Australia. And the half island was a Portuguese colony, but when the Portuguese left in 1975, the Indonesians occupied the half island and declared it part of Indonesia. The East Timorese were not happy about this, and there was a long, long, long civil war. And the Indonesians finally withdrew in 1999. People who were advocates for the East Timorese during this often called it a genocide and often said that hundreds of thousands of East Timorese had been murdered. Well, we worked for the East Timorese Truth Commission and we conducted a survey. In addition to our survey of households, we also surveyed every gravesite on the island. We also collected 8,000 testimonies of Timorese people who had stories to tell us about things that they and their family had suffered. And after doing all the elaborate math, we found that about 18,000 people had been killed by the Indonesian authorities. That's a long way from hundreds of thousands. Now, there were probably around 100 and 150,000 East Timorese who died as a result of hunger and disease in excess of what you would expect based on mortality patterns before the conflict. But they weren't killed exactly. Now, there's an interesting debate in international law. If people die as a result of, you know, preventing them from farming or preventing them from getting medical assistance or preventing them from moving food around and they die, what is the level of legal responsibility that the officials have? Okay, that's great. That's a legal argument. But what I'm talking about is, why did the people die? And they weren't killed. Many people died. And the activists were very unhappy with us. Turns out our Timorese partner was like, yeah, it checks out. That made sense. But the activists, primarily in Australia, to this day, will, you know, give me grief about it. So sometimes it happens, and sometimes we even publish about it.
We're getting close to the end of our hour, but I'm wondering, is there anything that keeps you up at night?
Oh, yeah. There's lots of things that keep me up at night. I'm wondering who is going to be documenting the disappearances in the United States, because I want to help them with the math. I'm wondering, how are we going to build a citizen-driven network for documentation? This is not my job, but I can be part of the back end for documentation on violence by the state. I don't think that I'm going too far afield, because many people in or close to the administration have called for extensive violence for a variety of purposes, whether it's against immigrants or it's against the people who politically or legally oppose actions by the administration. Many people in and close to the administration have called for violence against them. Okay, well, that's what we do. We analyze those patterns and we tell you know, quantitative stories about it. Who are the people who are going to do that documentation? I'd like to be in touch.
Yeah, I'm sure it's disturbing to have to measure so much violence, to have to measure so much death, to realize that such things are happening with such regularity.
Yeah.
I mean, I find it disturbing. I'm sure
it is
you
disturbing,
do too.
But I guess I've done it for so long, and I've known so many people who inspired me through their heroism to keep doing it. I won't comment on current events, but I did spend a couple months in Gaza in 2003. This was a really long time ago. This is before Hamas even came to power. They were just a annoying gang of thugs at that time. And I worked for a human rights organization, a heroic human rights organization, the Palestinian Center for Human Rights. And the founder and director of that organization, a guy named Raji Sarani, who's still around. Sometimes he speaks on American media interviews. He'd come into the office every morning and he'd say, "Good morning, sunshine," he would say to everyone after we had already talked about all the horrible things that happened the day before that we were making databases of and figuring out how to do statistics with. And I think about Raji all the time because it is our obligation, it seems to me, to look at these horrible things that are happening. It is our obligation to remember them, and it is our obligation to try to persuade all of our fellow citizens to oppose it, or if they're part of it, to cut it out, to treat everyone with dignity and fairness, and according to the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, the foundation of, I believe, decent governance. And we can't escape that obligation. So what Raji taught us is you have to do it cheerfully. You have to do it no matter what you feel. You have to bring your whole self to it every day and say, okay, it's another day. What do we got? Just think about that every day. He's a heroic man.
Well, thank you so much. I think that we've reached the end of the hour, and we really appreciate this. I mean, it's been fun, but it's also, we have a lot to think about.
Yeah, please come back and update us.
With pleasure. Thanks so much for having me.
It's been great to see you again, however virtually.
Yeah.
Okay, well, thanks, everybody.
You can stay in touch with Plutopia at plutopia.io. On Facebook, look for @PlutopiaNews. On Twitter, it's @Plutopia. This is the Plutopia News Network, 20 minutes into the future.